Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
What is macroeconomics and how has this developed since the crash? How should we think about globalization? An especially pertinent question given the current political climate. And how important are personal relationships and interactions in determining economic performance? All discussed in episode 7 of the Irish Economics Podcast. Hello everybody and welcome to this episode of the Irish Economics Podcast. So today I'm joined by Professor Stephen Kinsella, who is Associate Professor of Economics at the University of Limerick. So Stephen does a lot of work assessing the performance of the Irish macroeconomy, applying new methods to hopefully improve the way we tackle old problems. And this ranges from looking at economic forecasting and how we think about things like globalisation and policies of austerity, and even how we think about households and firms interact with each other and what are known as peer effects. So hopefully you can delve deeper into these topics today and understand the implications for Irish and international economy. So maybe the first topic that might be of interest is looking at what your work on macroeconomic modelling, and you try to look at some of the new approaches in this context. And maybe for the non-economists, we could start by looking at, well, what exactly is the macroeconomy? Some people might think that this is some sort of jargon. Maybe to try and break that down first and then say, well, why do we need to assess its performance?
So first off, thank you very much for having me. This is I'm excited to be here thanks again for doing this. What is the macroeconomy? So essentially the macroeconomy is the sum of the behaviors of everyone in the economy. So all the households, all the firms, what the government does, what people buy and sell from the rest of the world. And of course, what we invest. So and what is invested in us. When we think about the macroeconomy, when I'm teaching it, I often liken it to the human body. You know, you've got the different sectors that are essentially the organs, and flowing around the firms, you know, the households and so forth is money. Money flows. So almost the first thing we teach in macroeconomics is something called a circular flow model. What this is, it's got an explicit biological metaphor behind it. It was in fact invented by a doctor in France several hundred years ago. So it's very interesting that many of these biological metaphors carry over. So the fundamental thing about macroeconomics is that my expenditure is your income and your income is my expenditure. Mm. So it's fundamentally different from the way we think about the economics of the household, and it's fundamentally different from the way we think about how individual firms or individual sectors do their thing. It abstracts away from a lot of that, or at least in the past it used to abstract away from a lot of that. Yeah. Now it's really down with the data, but it's history. It's at its deepest roots is a concern with counting. I think the first ever macroeconomic document is something called Verbum Sapienti, from a guy called William Petty. So it means words to the wise.
Okay.
And basically, I think it's only 19 paragraphs, and you have a concern with counting people up, and you have a concern with inflation, you have a concern with unemployment. You know, I think it's from the 1690s, like forget what the exact date is, but it's an incredible document in that all of the major concerns that you will see in 2019 are sitting in that document.
Right, okay.
300-400 years ago. It's an extraordinary piece of writing. I'll send it on to you.
Okay, so the traditionally, I suppose, methods would have been restricted. We would have had pen and paper or maybe simple, very simple computing power. And would this have led to maybe simplifications in the modelling approaches? Or?
You've had to, you essentially begin macroeconomics from counting up who's doing what where. And even that counting process is quite partial. The technology that existed in the 30s and 40s when they really started thinking carefully about what everyone does in the macroeconomy was really, really limited. It was limited pretty much to the UK and the US when it first started. And there were actually a number of approaches to counting up what people did. There was something called input-output analysis. There's something called the national accounts, real sectoral accounts, and then flows of funds accounts and money flows. These are all totally different approaches. There was a thing in the 50s called activity analysis, which has totally fallen by the wayside. The history of macroeconomics is really the history of people trying to figure out what the best abstraction is.
Right, okay.
And that was true really up until about 10 years ago. So as much as 10 years ago, it was completely fine to write down a macro model that had... that you essentially assumed that there was one person in it. So this is something called a representative agent model.
Okay.
And that one person was sort of multiplied infinitely. And there were different preferences, whatever. And then what they did was this single individual, this cloned individual, did their best to maximize their income or minimize their work or maximize their leisure or whatever it was the problem was, subject to an intertemporal constraint. So the problem you always had was the economy was a bit like a rocket shooting off. But it was the mathematics that we use to describe it, it is literally rocket science.
Right. Okay.
It is literally rocket science that is used to describe how these things take off and land. And it's really nice mathematics, actually. Okay. It turns out to have been an abstraction too far.
Right.
In the key sense that it's an abstraction too far, in the key sense that it got us away from something that's really fundamental in the study of the economy, which is the balance sheet.
Right. Okay. So this is where we come on to maybe... The stocks and flows of money in the economy.
Exactly. So I started looking at what's called stock flow consistent macroeconomics in 2006. I had just arrived back from New York, where I did my PhD. And I was told, you're teaching monetary economics. And I said, okay, what do I do? what do I do here? And... luckily, I rang my PhD advisor and I said, what should I do? He said, well, there's this book I've just been sent to review. It's called Monetary Economics.
Right.
I think it's probably, right down your alley. And I said, okay, cool. Send it over to me. So he sent this book over by these two guys, Wynne Godley and Mark Lavoie. Okay. And this book was not unlike anything I'd ever read in macroeconomics in that it starts off from the data.
Okay.
It just goes, here's the data. And then it says, well, we're pretty sure people aren't rational. Yeah. We're pretty sure there are different ways to think about rationality, but we're going to assume that people basically do what they do and we're not able to see inside them.
Yeah.
Right. So unlike the representative agent model, which assumes that you know somebody at a psychological level.
Yeah.
Right. This says, well, we don't really know anybody, but we can count what they do.
Right.
So we should probably just look at the data first. So this starts from that counting exercise.
Right, okay.
That Petty did and that, in the 16th century and then people were trying to do, up until the 1950s and 60s and then sort of expand it. And then it just says, well, look, everything that comes from somewhere has to go somewhere.
Right.
If I buy you a cup of coffee, I get the coffee and the guy who sells me the coffee gets some money. Yeah. The money has flown out of my account into the coffee seller's account, and I have got a cup of coffee.
Yeah.
Right. And it's sort of it sounds really stupid, right? But but it's a really, really simple and kind of fundamental thing.
Yeah.
And then you can ask yourself questions about, well, okay, where does it go? Can you trace the flow? And there are data sets for doing that.
Yeah.
And so what I started doing was writing teaching notes about this new way of doing macroeconomics.
Okay.
Just for my students. And I taught myself the approach just by having the need to teach them something that wasn't everything is perfect.
Yeah.
And everybody's maximizing everything. And, you know, there's no such thing as a crisis. Because, of course, when I started teaching this, it was 2007. And
yeah.
Yes, indeed, there was a crisis. So coming back and saying, you know, well, the economy is moving pretty well. And all the previous textbooks were saying things like, well, you know, the economy is doing well. There's been this great moderation.
Yeah.
All that's nonsense now, right?
Yeah.
So I wasn't able to teach any of that stuff with a straight face.
Sure.
Whereas this stuff is saying, it's absolutely fine to get a balance sheet that's just out of whack.
Yeah.
You know, of course a firm can become insolvent. So the stock law thing has been going really well. So we've got a number of grants. I think we have about 2 million in grants for various postdocs. So lots of people have now done their PhDs and stuff in this. Lots of software has been written. And what was very interesting was I had a group of, I think it was 6 postdocs here at one stage in Limerick, and they were doing all these different types of models.
Right.
So if you admit a plurality of modeling approaches, well, you shouldn't be surprised when lots of different approaches come up.
Yeah.
So we ended up doing things that were strict stock flow models. So basically the way you do a stock flow model, unlike a traditional macro model where you get some data on capital, you get some data on labor, you get some data on output, you try to fit them together and see how they go over time. With this, you take very, very large balance sheet, national balance sheet data sets. For example, we did one for the Bank of England, working with 3 colleagues from the Bank of England over a couple of years.
Yeah.
And you know, we printed out the flow of funds of the United Kingdom.
Right.
And so we're in a room that's like, I don't know, 3 meters by 3 meters. It was about 8 meters long. Like, we just printed it off. It went across about 6 tables.
Right, okay.
It was a huge data set, right? And what was fascinating about the experience of working with policymakers was they were kind of saying, like, this has to be right, you know?
Yeah.
And you're kind of going, yeah, no, it does. It has to be right. And that imposing that discipline on the real world discipline on us was amazing. It was a really interesting experience.
And then, so the sort of methods you'd have to employ would be a lot more complicated to take into account all these different complexities.
That's right. So one of the big problems with these models, right, which is still totally unsolved, is you can't write down 1 or 2 equations.
Yeah.
I think you're talking about 60 or 70 equations, right? Yeah. And each of them has like at least one parameter.
Yeah.
Right. So in modeling terms, you're always asking yourself, what's the value of that parameter?
Yeah.
And what you find really interestingly, actually, is if you go beyond, I think a lot of our training as economists is very much in the household sector. Yeah. So if I ask you right now, like, what do you think is the marginal propensity to consume out of current income?
Right, yeah.
In Ireland, like, you've got, like, if you ask yourself that question for a second,
yeah,
you go, it has to be like 0.8, 0.9. In other words, like, I give you an extra 10 euros, yeah, you're probably going to spend
most of it.
Right? Which is fine. It's completely grand. Now, if I ask, what is the marginal propensity of a financial firm in the OFI sector, other financials, right? So this, a shadow bank or something.
Yeah.
What's its marginal propensity to save? You have no intuition of that.
Yeah.
Right. Absolutely. Like, whereas with the household sector, you totally have an intuition because it's closer to what your training is. You've seen some econometric data.
Yeah.
Nobody's done that stuff. Right.
Yeah.
So there's that. The time series data is pretty limited. Like, you're talking, it's quarterly data. It's super noisy.
Mm.
The best countries in the world, like, we got a grant to do one for the Irish economy. Totally couldn't do one.
Right.
Like, we just couldn't
just
do it.
Just didn't have the data.
We literally didn't have the data. We're like, I just have to wait around another 10 years yeah. and I'll do the data. Right. Then I'll do it. It'll be fine. But at the time, in 2011, when got the grant, we just had 11 years of data.
So you had loads of people taking different approaches. And was it a case of, well, we have to find what's the way to go here? And we don't really know what we were going, but
exactly.
we want to go down different avenues and see which one is most successful.
Yeah. So we did this sort of let many flowers bloom thing, which was really inefficient from a research perspective, but was really efficient from an ideas perspective. So in terms of research outputs, like we got two or three a year. If we'd just gone, everyone will do this one thing, we would have had 20.
Right.
Right. So in terms of the production possibilities frontier of research, you know, we were putting out 5-6 journal articles a year, which for 6 people is pretty small,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
That's not a great return on investment. But in terms of the ideas, it was incredibly interesting. Incredibly interesting. So some of the guys realized that because we have this data that's basically at the sectoral level, you know, it's like households and firms,
yeah.
we've kind of nothing underpinning why those households do those things. So a really nice aspect of the other macroeconomics that I was telling you about before is that they actually have a really, really good story about why people are doing things,
yeah.
like individuals. The problem is all those individuals are highly homogenous and they can't do things like default on loans.
Okay.
Or at least they couldn't. So I'll come on to that in a minute.
Right.
But in 2006, 2007, they couldn't. So, yeah. So one of the lads started saying, well, look, we clearly need an agent-based model.
Yeah.
We need to be able to specify the agents in the system at a very, very granular level. And I was saying, yeah, okay, so computationally, how difficult is that? And they said, well, we will need a supercomputer.
Yeah. It's verging on data science.
Have you got one? And I said, well, I don't have one.
Yeah.
But I could get us some money and we could build one. So we built these servers out of something called, what are they called? They're called, they're graphical engines. So the graphics card of a computer is the fastest part of it, typically.
Right.
And so we wrote the software in order to maximize this graphics card thing.
Right. Okay.
So we had to build these kind of server things, which was a really exciting and slightly terrifying day because I'd spent, you know, a good quarter of the grant on these little black box yokes.
Yeah.
And if they didn't work, we were screwed. So we put these things together and they work great. So we built this piece of software, which is freely available now. It's a platform and it's called JMAP. And basically, it's an agent-based modeler that has a stock flow consistent component on top of it.
Right.
So we impose the discipline of everything must go somewhere, right?
Okay.
We have to map the stocks to the flows, no problem. But then we also impose a further discipline, which is that everyone's flows somewhere within the system go somewhere. So there once you've got that modeling set up there, you're able to do bank runs. You're able to talk about what happens when firms go out of business. You're able to talk about what happens when some of the agents in the system are a bit crazier than the others, you know, and they're really into investing and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So cool. Really, really cool. Took like 2 days to run these things, but they were great. And the graphics that came out of them were just sweet.
Yeah.
And some really good publications. So some of them, so the graphical capability really impressed me. So we got papers published in the Journal of Economic Dynamics and Control.
Very nice.
With people like Joe Stiglitz. He was very interested in this approach. And the accounting organizations and society, places like that, Cambridge Journal of Economics. So like it was getting well published. It was really good. And then I got quite interested in the mathematical connections between the graphs that we were producing.
Right.
And the mathematical elements of the stock flow consistent approach.
Yeah.
So I did a PhD in NUI Galway.
Before
I went to New York, about these mathematical approaches.
Right. Okay.
So shout out to NUI Galway for putting up with both of us for that long.
yeah.
But what was really exciting about that was, I was able to take some of the mathematical training that I'd done in Galway.
Right, okay.
And apply it here. So what we did was, and this got published in the Journal of Computational Economics, we proved that there's a strict correspondence between every stock flow consistent model and what's called a directed acyclic graph.
Right, okay.
Which, and so you're able to show that because the money goes from one place to another, the verb to is exactly corresponding to the what's called a vertex. So it literally moves in that direction.
Yeah.
So it's super cool and great fun.
So these,
great fun.
So these models then, were they, you said you're using bank, like English data.
Yeah.
Was this calibrated to English data or was it at this stage just a sort of a toy model that was?
Oh yeah, so great question. So some of them are toy models where you basically like knock up some data and then just like run some econometrics. Oh, that's another problem with this data, with these models, by the way. The econometrics are super, super simple.
Right, okay.
Right, because in order to maintain stock flow consistency, you know, I spend 100, you take in 100.
Hmm.
What that actually requires is that everything has to stay in nominal terms. So you can't like first difference anything.
Okay.
You can't take the log of something. So you have to get, you're working on these super, super complicated models, right?
Yeah.
Incredibly complicated models, 60, 70, 80 equations. And then you're putting it through the simplest kind of econometrics you can get your hands on. And so reviewers have quite rightly said, lads, come on, you know, you're not really at the races here with this. And they're completely right. The problem is Godley and Lavoie wrote these models. They didn't write them in order to have an econometric specification.
Yeah.
Right. So empirical stock flow consistent modeling is really still, there's still less than 10 of these done. So I've done one for Italy. I've done one for Australia, which just came out, completely unoriginally, we call it the Matilda model.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, God, you know, but anyway, it was an Australian, by the way, who came up with that idea. Okay. But yeah. And so these models are interesting, but, I have to say that what they taught me was that you have to respect these things in a system.
Yeah.
But they also probably taught me that you can only really go so far with these models before you come up against the necessary problem of having to make a reliable forecast with them.
Yeah, and then the tools...
Then the tools just fall apart.
Yeah.
So there is an agent-based approach to this stuff. There's an econometric approach to this stuff. There's a kind of a mathematical Bayesian directed acyclic graph approach to this stuff. And each time we did one, and I must have written 20 of them at this point, like, and everybody from that group has gone on to do one for their own economy. So there's one for Denmark, for example, a former PhD student.
Right.
Another guy who went straight from a postdoc to an associate professorship.
Okay.
From nice. Here. He's done a few for like Colombia, places like that, you know. So they're starting to find their way into policy related discussions.
Yeah.
But for me as an academic, the modeling framework hasn't evolved at sufficient speed. They're still like mathematically speaking, that they're still not dynamically stable, for example.
Okay.
Right. I mean, this may be a little bit too in the weeds for the podcast, but there is a serious problem with pricing. So
yeah.
You can't, you prices have to be relatively stable or in a stable corridor to get this stuff to work. So it's like, I'm really interested in the literature, but I feel like at least for the moment, and I'd be refereeing papers on this kind of all the time, I can't see yet the major methodological innovation, because it's not a question of the theory. The theory is fine.
Yeah.
It's not a question of the econometrics, because we can't get the data to cohere with the econometrics, right?
Yeah.
It's a question of what is the methodological innovation that brings us closer to a really nice solution like that makes a really nice, coherent model that has some predictive ability.
So you were saying that sometimes. So basically, it seemed these are very novel methods, and when you write up your paper, you send it on, and then reviewers look at it and say, "Well, this isn't what I'm used to looking at," and there can be some pushback there. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like it can be difficult to get things out there in that
sense?
Oh,
it's definitely difficult. I mean, there's a lot of these papers that are just sitting as working papers, right?
Yeah.
But what I think, and while my co-authors are apt to get a bit down about this, you see, oh, the mainstream are against us. They're not really. They're curious, yeah. Right? If we were writing what's called the dynamic stochastic general equilibrium model,
yeah.
Which they've all seen before.
Yeah.
There's a format to writing these papers. You just knock them up and then you go, here's my little twist. And people go, oh, that's grand or that's not grand. And they move on. With ours, we have to go, there's this thing, right? It's really complicated, guys. Here's 10 pages on this. So you kind of have to sweat through it. And so it becomes a very interesting communication challenge.
Yeah.
And I'm somebody, really I think about communicating economics a lot. So I've been for a different sort of part of my work, and I've really kind of just obsessed about how to teach these models and how to really get them over to people's idea into people's minds. One of the things I have thought about doing in the past was doing like an online course, you know, to show people what this looks like. So If you go onto YouTube, like, what is stuff flow consistent economics? Like, you get these just, you know, kindly sit through my 2-hour lecture where I bloviate at a whiteboard. Like, that's not what people want, you know?
Yeah.
They want very short, 8-minute, here's an example, here's some literature, here you go.
Yeah.
There are only so many hours in the day. But you have to do that communication bit, right? So it's not that there's this, you know, closed-mindedness out there. They're just people who are very busy.
Sure.
You know, and they've got 16 papers to review. Like, I think I've got 8 to review right now. Like, and they're just going, oh, come on. You know, and you just have to get over that hurdle. And that's a communication challenge as much as anything else.
Yeah,
which is interesting.
So another thing then that came to mind was, so you're talking about these sort of new methods applied to macroeconomic modelling and the stock flow consistency is one aspect of that. But then I know in this rebuilding macro project that you're working on, it seems to be bringing in a lot of different disciplines like anthropologists. And
yeah,
when people think about economics, they don't think about these sort of people getting involved.
They don't.
So how does that fit into this whole modeling framework? Is it that we have this ensemble of different viewpoints, or do you say, well, this is what they say, and we plug this in as a parameter into our model, or would it be a bit of both, maybe?
It's a bit of both. So what Rebuilding Macro is in 6 hubs, and the hub that I lead is called Can Globalization Benefit All?
Mm-hmm.
I was very struck in 2016 at how shocked everyone was by Trump and Brexit and all of that. Yeah. But I had also had a really profound experience in Ireland, having lived through this austerity period. We are sitting in the Kemi Business School in the University of Limerick, which had its own austerity, right?
Right.
So I once had a situation where, you know, you'd go to get some stationery, you know, yeah. And somebody would take an eraser and cut it in half and give it to you.
Right. Okay.
So we lived through this period. We all, you know, we all had our pay cut,
yeah.
All this kind of stuff. So it's an interesting problem in that having lived through these crises, I'm aware that some people are made better off by globalization and some people are made worse off. I mean, we are Irish, right? We are definitely the winners from this. But we do impose losses on others, right?
Mm.
And you're not going to. It's a substantial threat, in my view. And this is moving into international political economy rather than macroeconomics, which is a different thing. But it just struck me, having done a lot of reading about it, that unless we were able to include into our macro models the fact that the family matters, right? we weren't going to be able to explain certain effects. For example, when a large factory leaves a town in Vietnam, its effects are totally different to the same firm leaving a town in India.
Right.
And the reason is family structures, right? Okay. The family structures, and this is very well published, Journal of International Economics, 2014 work by colleagues from Dartmouth. And what they found was just familial ties were stronger and the social welfare networks were local.
Okay.
So you were only able to claim the dole in your own area and your family structure was very important to you in India. Whereas in Vietnam, the people had just dispersed and went off and did their thing. Not that family isn't important in Vietnam, it's just not as strong. Right. It's not a controlling variable. So as a macroeconomist, that tells you family matters.
Yeah.
Well, how do you model a family in a macro model? It's really, really hard, right?
Yeah.
Or take the experience of debt. We know colleagues at the Central Bank in Ireland have shown us that, and they've shown it econometrically, that the experience of excessive indebtedness, so it's not that you just owe some money, like you owe way more than you'll ever be able to pay back. It actually damages consumption for decades into the future. Now, there's no macroeconomic reason why that's true, right?
Yeah, yeah.
There's a thing in most macro models, it's called the transversality condition, and basically you go past this and then you're so in debt it doesn't matter. You go back to what you were doing before. And it's like, well, no, that does matter. So the idea of the globalization benefiting all part is to take some of the stuff that we learned from the INET projects, like there's an agent-based stock flow model in that project.
Mm.
There's also stuff about the new economics of belonging from a geographer and an anthropologist, like what does it mean to belong?
Yeah, right. That was really interesting.
Yeah. So there's six different approaches and each of them has to say, like, in order to get the money, they have to show, like, why is this relevant? So, for example, we've got one on global value chains.
Yeah.
Why are global value chains important? The construction of social identity in Switzerland is about we follow the rules. Right.
Okay.
And if you think about the construction of social identity in Ireland, it's something to the effect of like, we were oppressed, right? You know what I mean? Like, and we are not now, unless you're like, I don't know, the Irish rugby team or something. They weren't oppressed. They were just beaten. Yeah. But no, the main thing there is, when you think about it carefully, you go, okay, so Swiss people think that we follow the rules. Swiss multinationals in their supply chains do not follow the rules. So globalization is value chains. It is just the fact that the iPhone is assembled in China and sold everywhere else.
So when they don't follow the rules, what does that mean?
Swiss social activists get together and coalesce and they say, you are Swiss. You are not like us. You must change. And the Swiss companies go, yeah, no, that's fair enough. We should change.
Right.
So you've got a giant multinational company, you know, bigger than the GDP of Ireland, altering its behavior, and that alters globalization, right?
Okay.
And does that benefit all or not?
Okay,
that's an open question.
So that changes their behavior down throughout the different supply chains and where they're operating in different countries, and therefore that affects the households in these countries. And,
yes.
Okay, right.
So that's from a geographer's perspective, right?
Sure.
But then from an anthropological perspective, you go to a place in the south of England, where they've seen vast industrializations, and they say, well, you know, a macroeconomist will say, well, it's grand. We'll increase taxes on the rich people. We'll send you some money. That'll be great. And what they've shown is like, no. There, this idea of being in a depressed region, it's far greater than any monetary transfer can compensate us for, even if there were a monetary transfer, which, by the way, there is not.
Yeah.
Right. There's a brilliant book by a guy called Michael Trebilco, and it's called Dealing with the Losers.
Right.
And this book completely changed my mind.
Okay.
Like, I would have been a pretty standard, you know, well, just tax the rich lads, send some money to the poor lads, job done. No.
So people who are in these depressed regions, they have... Like, there would always be a social argument for some sort of transfer to help people who are in bad conditions. But maybe now there's an economic reason because it feeds back into your perspective, into your how you perform at work, things like that.
Yep,
and one thing that comes to mind then, alongside that is you think see things like maybe areas of Detroit where, you know, it's depressed now after motor industry left, and this leads to sort of inequality and political activism. And this has, you know, feedback loops into the economy, and that wouldn't be accounted for traditionally.
Exactly. And this is why when we want to think about globalization, we have to use a political economy lens. Right, we have to talk about ideas and interests and institutions. So again, this comes back a bit like the stock flow macro stuff to teaching. Right. So I'm teaching a course called International Political Economy in the concert hall in about, I don't know, half an hour and 28 minutes. And one of the things that I talk about all the time is the interaction of ideas, interests and institutions. It's really hard to get those into a macro model.
Yeah.
Because many macro models abstract away from institutional boundaries. Now that's starting to happen as well in macro. So do you remember I was telling you that the kind of standard mainstream macro models weren't able to cope with, you know, bank runs and banking collapses and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah.
Well, they are now. You know, like, it's not fair to say that these models aren't evolving. They are, and at a prodigious rate, actually.
Yeah.
So it's not uncommon now to open an issue of the Journal of Monetary Economics, which is the main macro journal in the world, and see, you know, a DSGE model where you've got loads and loads of banks going under.
Yeah.
So the science is moving forward, right? Slowly and imperfectly and whatever, and not as fast as you might like, but it is moving forward. I think that as economics moves to become a more empirical science, the people who have the data and the people who have the ability to really, really work with that data, they're the people who will generate the most value. And so I've been working on a series of projects with the Central Statistics Office and the Department of Business here about labor market flows. Right. So because it's just really clear, we're becoming an empirical science where the modeling, if you take the modeling to its most extreme, and I've gone pretty far, I'm not saying I'm the most extreme at all, but I've gone pretty far down those lines. I spent a number of years thinking carefully about this stuff. Yeah. You come across the problem that ultimately, when it really comes down to it, you're not dealing with real data.
Yeah.
That's the problem. You can have all the methodological innovation you want. You can be as fancy econometrically as you like. You're not dealing with real data. You're dealing with aggregated, estimated, interpolated data.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, like, what do you do? Well, you go looking for where there's a big, broad data set of all the things.
Nice.
And so I went looking for that. And I gave up because I couldn't find it. And then I was at an INET conference.
Very good.
And it came to me. So this postdoc met me, and an extremely brilliant person.
Yeah.
Really brilliant person. Her name is Niamh O'Cleary, and she was a postdoc at Harvard and then moved to Oxford and is now moving to UCL as a professor.
Right, very good.
Skipping all steps in between because she's awesome.
Right.
She's a network scientist. She's a mathematician. She does network stuff. And she was saying, well, look, I have this idea for this network model and I know somebody in the CSO. Could we give this a bit of a lash? And I was like, yes, yes, we can.
Yeah, okay.
So we have this paper looking at labor flows in the Irish economy. So you leave Potsdam, or no, let's say you leave Trinity and you come to UL.
Yeah.
Right? Or you leave UL and you go to Dell.
Yeah.
That's one flow out. Right? And then if I leave Dell and I come to UL, that's flow in.
Yeah.
So we have the net labor flow.
Right. Okay. So
yeah, at the sectoral level, but we have it for the entire economy.
Okay.
Literally the whole thing. So this is macroeconomics, right? Like, it goes back to Petty, Petty's verbum sapienti.
Mm.
Yeah. So it's literally counting up all the stuff. It's the entire Irish economy.
Yeah.
There's no macro model there. There's no stock flow, anything. I mean, it is interesting that the stock flow idea comes in.
Yes.
Obviously it's stock flow inconsistent.
Yeah.
Because you've got all these workers and they're leaving the country.
Yes.
So we've got an estimate of how many workers are leaving the country and how many workers are losing their jobs.
Right, okay.
But anyway, long story short, we're able to use these network models to build a picture of the Irish economy.
Okay, and so
by
you're,
sector.
So you're applying these, you're bringing in mathematical techniques,
yeah.
and a lot of, so it's very much interdisciplinary
yeah,
type
yeah, yeah.
of approach.
It's all, my approach to economics is to ask a question, yeah. ask, why is that thing like that?
Yeah.
And then try really hard to come up with an answer. And it takes you over these really weird terrains, right? You find yourself sitting in a room talking about Swiss activists, do you know?
Right, okay.
And you find yourself in rooms talking about the nature of shadow banking and in rooms talking about the legal issues around data sharing.
Yeah.
And knocking up supercomputer stuff and just spending a lot of your time kind of going like, why am I doing any of this? You know, like it's a really exciting way to do economics. It's just really scattershot.
Yeah.
It's all over the shop.
If you have this open approach and you take into all these ideas, eventually you hit on something that works.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's worked in the sense that, I and the people who work with me are quite happy to come to work every day.
Mm.
And it's worked in the sense that the, you know, the journals like it. It's worked in the sense that, you know, there are central banks and policy places using these models.
Yeah.
And it's worked in the sense that there are still government departments who are interested in this stuff.
Mm.
To the extent that it gets published in the American Economic Review or the Journal of Monetary Economics, is to my mind, it's not even a secondary question.
Yeah.
I'm far more interested in just having a lash. Like, I'm really excited to do this labour flow stuff because we have one of the big questions in Ireland, which is a political economy question, is what is the role of the multinational in Ireland in an era of de-globalisation, right? In order to answer that question, you have to know a lot about the multinationals in Ireland.
Yeah.
And like, and to do that using a network approach with labour flow data is a really, really, really interesting question. I have no idea what the answer is.
One thing I just wanted to mention was you have an interesting paper on agent-based modelling looking at crop adoption. You're talking about families and the importance of families. And I think one of the results there was that basically if you're in a developing country, if you're trying to encourage the adoption of these new technologies, and people with good, strong family connections tends to proliferate a lot quicker. So this would, the policy implication to me there is that, well, if we're going to seed these new technologies, we want to start with people who have good families. Would that be?
Yeah. So this was a paper with my former PhD student, who's now a full professor in China, Hang Zhang, and with the late dearly missed Professor Diane Payne from UCD. She just passed away this year, very sadly. And so the idea of this paper was Hang went to China, to where he's from, and he was talking about the adoption of two different crops. And he was just looking at it. And it was not rational to do. Like, no rational crop producer would produce either of these crops.
Okay.
Because of the weather and because of the uncertainty associated with the price and the quantity and so on and so forth. What he showed was that familial structure was the determining variable. So if I was your uncle and I had these seeds, I would be far more likely to give the seeds to you than to someone else, regardless of whatever price you paid.
Yeah.
Right. And what was interesting about this was we were able to replicate that behavior, which he studied experimentally. So he went out and talked to them and listened to them and surveyed them and so forth. So we got real on the ground data, what we're now calling thick data. We used to call it talking to people, but now thick data.
Right.
I don't know, whatever. I mean, it's the term. It's the term in the literature. You have to use thick data. So, all right, you heard it here, folks, on the Irish Economics Podcast, thick data. So, yeah, it's thick data. So he just went talking to people. And then the paper allowed two things. The first was and I think this is chapter 3 of his thesis, maybe chapter 4. The paper shows that experimentally and in an agent-based way, you were able to show the propagation of the crops using the familial networks.
Yes.
You know, so it's a really, really nice paper. And Hang is an extraordinary social scientist in that he's somebody who combines really, really deep technical expertise. I mean, you know, he was sort of at the computer all day, every day for months trying to get this thing to work, with the ability to go and survey a giant area of rural China.
Wow.
No bother, you know. And it's those two skill sets are quite, or at least in the past, have been in independent of one another, or at least they haven't been as dependent on one another as you might like. But it was proper economics, like really good economics. He went and had the app to people that informed what he was doing. Then he had the model,
yeah.
Built the model, and then he showed the model back to the people, and they were like, "Yeah, no, that seems like it. That's how it went, right?" So yeah. So he was able to kind of find something out about the structure of the society in which he lived that I don't think he'd be able to find using a traditional macro model or even like a network-based model, right?
Right.
Even though that model that he builds actually does have some network components in it, because I was just really interested to see what would happen. But one of the other great privileges of doing this stuff is just working with people who are, they're just excellent. I mean, they're just really, really excellent people. One day I was chatting to him and I was like, "What's wrong with you?" And he goes, "Oh, I was just up all night. The lad was nearly dead. He was underneath the table in bits because he'd been up coding all night." Yeah. And I remember doing that myself, my PhD. And I just thought, isn't it wonderful to be around people? I didn't ask him to do this. Like,
yeah, of course, he did it himself.
He just flaked off and did it himself. And it's just really exciting to do that kind
of
work.
Yeah, well, obviously passionate about what he does.
Yeah.
Okay, I don't want to hold you up any more.
No worries.
Stephen, thanks a million. That was
my
pleasure. Interesting chat, and yeah, really enjoyed it actually.
No, my pleasure, my pleasure. Thank you very much for listening to me and putting up with me. And I wish you every success with the podcast going forward. I think it's a brilliant idea.
Okay, thanks, Stephen. All the best.
So there are two, maybe three more episodes left in this first series, and I really want to get as many listeners on board as possible over the next couple of weeks. So if you have a friend with an interest in some of the topics discussed, colleagues, if you're at school or college, please mention the podcast whenever you get a chance. If you're on social media, a tweet on Twitter or a tag on Instagram always leads to new listeners. So please, if you've enjoyed any of the episodes so far, let the world know by tagging @IrishEconPod on Twitter, Instagram or Facebook, and help me with giving the podcast a big social media push this week. That would be really appreciated. So thank you, everybody, and look forward to talking to you next week.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.